Please rise. Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is January 16, 2020. This panel of the court today is in courtroom 200. We have six cases on our calendar today, four of which will be submitted with oral argument, and two of which will be submitted without oral argument, solely on the briefs. The first case for oral argument is In Re, the Civil Commitment of Leon Opiacha, and I would be happy to have my pronunciation corrected when the time comes. That's case number A19-1693. As the lawyers know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, and then appellant's counsel will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You may approach and begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Michael Hager on behalf of Leon Opiacha. And in this case, we're not appealing so much from a final disposition as we are a decision at the end of a phase one hearing as to the competency of the court's examiner, such as to produce sufficient evidence to constitute a prima facie case. And we're relying on Coker v. Jessen that controls phase one hearings in which the evidence is, as is traditional for a prima facie case, the evidence is not questioned as to credibility. There's the evidence. And is to be viewed in the light most favorable to the producer of that evidence. And in almost all cases that I know of, that certainly followed. This is a case that is somewhat anomalous in which the court's own examiner, the panel's own examiner, found to be incompetent to testify.
Incompetent? Well, his report and testimony were admitted into evidence, correct?
Yes. And as to his opinion, the panel severed his final opinion from the facts that he found and said that as to the law, he could not apply the law as he saw it, and they did not view it as a mixed fact and law question.
But is it the medical examiner's role to be interpreting the law?
Yes, absolutely. They have to determine, for example, if he had been put the ultimate question would have been, is he completely out of control? They didn't ask that question. That's an examiner who provides that question.
Why is completely out of control even relevant to a discharge or transfer decision?
Because it goes back to Pearson, and then Pearson was adopted in Johnson v. Newt, and it's the standard that the panel applied. The panel applied that standard and said that he did not follow that standard, but he was never even asked about that. And if he had been asked about it and says, yes, he's completely out of control, it would have been against the facts. The facts are that he's been under control for 3 years. He's been assault-free. So Dr. Gearock was not going to say he was completely out of control. The standard actually put in the decision was, is he still dangerous? And that's clearly not the standard that's been developed. But the problem was is that they substituted a fact that was not in evidence, that he's completely out of control. They would need another examiner to come in and opine he is completely out of control. And this is
that one of the statutory discharge factors? I'm looking at the statute right now, and it indicates 253B.18 subdivision 15 that a patient may be discharged if the patient is capable of making an acceptable adjustment to open society. Number two, no longer dangerous to the public, and number three, no longer in need of treatment or supervision.
Yeah.
And did Dr. Gearock establish facts to support those three?
As to provisional discharge, but he said he's not mentally ill. So that's another statute. That's not under that statute. Is he mentally ill or not? And
well, that's more of your due process argument, right? The argument under call that his continued... I mean, we're not here reviewing the initial commitment back in 2014, are we?
No, we're reviewing Dr. Gerock's report, whether it's incompetent, whether a panel could reasonably say that its own examiner is incompetent, that evidence is irrelevant. And I'm saying that Dr. Gerock went through the different categories and he rendered a competent opinion. Now, another examiner may disagree, but that's his opinion that he's not mentally ill.
Mr. Hager, you used that phrase incompetent a couple times, but I didn't see that in the order. Is there a particular finding where or is it the end result that you're drawing that inference from?
Well, our burden of production is in this special arena of phase one hearing is to produce competent evidence. That is, Opiatch's mother does not produce competent evidence in a phase one hearing. Dr. Gerock produces competent evidence. We need to produce some opinion that if it went on to phase two and it were proven, could prevail.
Is it true, if we set aside for a moment the definition of mental illness and just look at the three statutory factors for discharge, would it be true that it's undisputed that the doctor opined no to each of those factors?
If he were mentally ill, but okay. He's saying he's not mentally ill.
So really the sole issue then, if we look back at it, that your client raises is this issue of whether antisocial personality disorder is a mental illness as the statute would require.
The question is whether Dr. Gerock is incompetent to say whether he's mentally ill or not. And this cuts totally against his appointment. He was assumed to be competent to make that call. He made that call, and then the court came back and undercut him.
But again, is that a material issue for purposes of transfer or discharge? I understand how it is in terms of the initial commitment, but that wasn't the issue presented before the commitment appeal panel.
Quite at issue on discharge, as Dr. Gerock rightly said. And his discharge was being supported by his doctor. And MSH has consistently objected to this particular commitment. They objected initially, and they've continued. They're not designed to treat people with antisocial personality disorders. And that's never been considered a major mental illness. And if we were to apply this standard, then, half the people in prison should be at St. Peter, because they do not treat antisocial personality disorders, and they said that.
The requirement of mental illness that you're referring to, is that... What's the source of that requirement? Is it a matter of state statute or is it a matter of federal constitutional law?
State statute as to what is a mental illness for purposes of commitment, a substantial psychiatric illness, a major mental illness. That was the gravamen at trial originally. You take the whole history of this case.
The commitment trial. But what about on a proceeding for discharge? Definition of mental illness, is it incorporated into the statutory discharge criteria?
Absolutely. If he's no longer mentally ill, they don't want to treat him. He should be discharged. They don't have any treatment for him. There's no purpose for him being there. There's no rational relation to the original commitment, which was for a psychosis.
The three requirements that Judge Bjorkman read a minute ago, none of the three says he must still be mentally ill. So where are you finding that requirement?
Oh, well, Dr. Gerock cited...
No, but no, where in the law? Where in the law? I mean, if you're saying as a matter of state statutory law, a person must be discharged if he or she is no longer mentally ill, where is that from?
Well, the law is not going to say that, but the law applies to people who are mentally ill. I don't know if that's in the caption of that statute. It applies to people who have been mentally ill and dangerous. He's no longer mentally ill, so that no longer applies. He's not mentally ill. This is now preventive detention.
I understand the logic of your argument. I mean, there is some common sense to it. I'm asking where in the statute is that concept incorporated?
Where the statute says mentally ill. They're assuming he's mentally ill. In the statute, under those transfer, provisional discharge, and discharge standards.
And the statute that Judge Bjorkman read from, it begins by saying, that subdivision begins by saying, a patient who is mentally ill and dangerous shall not be discharged unless.
That's right, he's not mentally ill.
So in a sense, I think, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but I think you're saying that it's in addition to the three criteria that are expressly laid out, it's one of the inherent requirements to conduct that analysis. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Dr. Gearock understands this. He's a very highly skilled professional. He came through with a decision that's his opinion. Another examiner may disagree, but it's a competent opinion.
And I think Dr. Gearock was incorporating concepts of the federal constitutional law, right?
Yes, which were early on incorporated into Minnesota decisions, even cited by the panel of Johnson versus Newt. We understand where this came from. This all came from Pearson. Originally, nobody considered antisocial personality disorder to have any relevance to sexual psychopathic personalities. But in dictum, it was Justice Amdahl, I believe, who opined that it's possible that somebody could have an antisocial personality disorder, that they're so utterly without control that then that commitment should go forward in a mentally ill and dangerous situation. But that criteria is very high, and it was applied by the panel as completely lacking control. There's no evidence that Opiatcha was completely lacking control.
But why doesn't, just sort of philosophically, a severe antisocial personality disorder, which, as in this case, has manifested in repeated assaults that landed him in prison during the course of his hospitalization and upon his return resulted in imposition of a very tight behavioral management plan. Why doesn't that type of a mental health condition satisfy the due process concern that the commitment be reasonably related, the ongoing commitment be reasonably related to the original commitment?
Well, historically, the original commitment was to treat him for a psychosis. No treatment for the antisocial personality disorder. They want to piggyback the dangerousness, and this is why Fouchard was cited. They want to those cases, Johnson versus Newt, were incredibly dangerous people. I think one was a murderer. They did not rise to the level of being completely, utterly lacking in control. That was the standard that was established.
Those were original commitment decisions?
No, I think those were release decisions. I think there have been some release decisions on this point. I think they were. They were.
If Judge Berkman's done.
I'm done.
I have a question. Could you please refer to page 15 of the red brief, the one submitted by your opposing counsel?
I thought I had it with me, and I didn't.
I wonder if Mr. Dietrich could lend you his copy. So at the top of the page in the indented quote is a statutory definition of person who is mentally ill. I don't believe you addressed this in your reply brief, and so that's why I wanted to get your response to this argument by the commissioner that this statutory definition applies and that it and that his ASPD fits within it.
Dr. Gearock explained the distinction between a volitional disorder, which is antisocial personality disorder. It's volitional. So it's not based on an organic disorder or a substantial psychiatric disorder. There's nothing chemically going on. that disturbs his behavior. Dr. Burek was quite clear about that. This is volitional, and this is why antisocial personality disorder is not treated at MSH. They have no treatment for it. It's volitional.
Looking at the definition, could ASP ASPD be considered a substantial psychiatric disorder of thought, mood, perception, orientation, or memory, which grossly impairs judgment, behavior, capacity to recognize reality, or to reason, to understand, and so on?
I think Dr. Burek answered no. I think that's in the panel disagreed with him, but that's his professional judgment. And that's been the professional judgment, I would assume, of all the examiners, because he read the initial commitment. They all assumed that if it were just antisocial personality disorder, he wouldn't be committed. But this is not reinventing the wheel. This is something that examiners deal with every day.
Can I ask a follow-up
question? Yeah, of course.
The same page of the respondent's brief goes on to state that the doctor, in fact, testified that antisocial personality disorder is a psychiatric disorder and is classified as such in the DSM-5. Doesn't that undercut your legal argument about what the statute defines?
It may be. I don't think it qualified as a major mental illness or whatever the
not
terminology.
Not substantial.
Severe was his term. There's no diagnostically significant terminology of a severe antisocial personality disorder. That certainly was not his testimony, that there's some special meaning to the severity of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hager. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal argument. Mr. Dietrich, on behalf of the commissioner.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is R.J. Dietrich. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent, the Commissioner of Human Services. Now, in this matter, at the Part 1 hearing, it was appellant's burden to present a prima facie case with competent evidence to show that he was entitled to discharge. And the discharge criteria, as interpreted by the Minnesota Supreme Court in Call versus Gomez, require a person to be discharged if they either no longer need treatment and supervision for a mental disorder or no longer pose a danger to the public. Now, the only evidence that appellant presented at the Part 1 hearing was Dr. Gierock's testimony and Dr. Gierock's report. And Dr. Gierock clearly testified that appellant suffers from a severe and extreme form of antisocial personality disorder. He testified that antisocial personality disorder is what led to the violent behavior that resulted in appellant's initial commitment and is also what led to the violent and aggressive behavior that appellant has continued to demonstrate throughout his commitment at the Minnesota Security Hospital. Dr. Gierock also testified that disorder continues to make appellant dangerous to the public and that disorder... that he continues to need supervision for that disorder and continues to need treatment for that disorder. And he, contrary to Mr. Hager's statements, there is treatment available for antisocial personality disorder at Minnesota Security Hospital. And Dr. Gierock testified that appellant is receiving that treatment. Indeed, it's the best treatment available for him. He did
available for him in that setting. I mean, I understood Dr. Gierock's testimony to be that this particular program is not set up to deal with these types of personality disorders, and that, you know, at the time of his commitment, he carried a different diagnosis, but the place isn't really designed for people like him. I mean, isn't that the basis for Dr. Gierock's testimony that discharge is appropriate because the treatment isn't right for him here?
Your Honor, he testified that he is receiving the best treatment that is available, I believe, for his disorder. He did testify that antisocial personality disorder is notoriously difficult to treat, but The U.S. Supreme Court said in Kansas versus Hendricks that just because you can't treat someone's mental disorder, as long as they suffer from a disorder and it continues to make them dangerous, that doesn't mean they can't continue to be committed. So I don't think that means that he's entitled to discharge. Although Dr. Girac ultimately stated that his conclusion was that appellant should be discharged, he based that legal conclusion, as the commitment appeal panel said, on an erroneous reading of the law. He said that the original commitment needs to be reasonably related to the reason for continued commitment. And that's true, but he defined that as appellant needing to continue to suffer from the schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder that he was diagnosed with at the time of his original commitment. Well, he was also diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder at the time of his commitment. And as the commitment appeal panel said, the call specifically defines reasonably related to the original reason for commitment as continuing to need treatment and supervision for a mental disorder and continuing to pose a danger to the public. And I think Dr. Girac's testimony clearly shows that he met that criteria.
I'm assuming, just to clarify that point you made, that that presupposes that the patient continues whatever the separate diagnosis or new diagnosis or diagnosis that's left still meets the statutory definition of mental illness.
Certainly, he continues to need to have a mental disorder. I don't know that it necessarily needs to rise completely to the level of the initial commitment criteria, because as the court also said in a call, that's not the standard for continued commitment. Yes, you need to continue to have a mental disorder and need to continue to pose a danger to the public, but Call said clearly that even if there is a slight improvement in someone's condition and they no longer meet the initial commitment criteria, that does not mean that they meet discharge criteria and they need to be discharged. So
That's federal constitutional law. What about state statutory law?
No, Your Honor, that is Call versus Gomez, a Minnesota State Supreme Court case interpreting Minnesota law.
Well, interpreting Minnesota law, as I read Call v. Gomez, interpreting the statutory discharge criteria in a way that's consistent with federal constitutional law. I mean, it seems to me that the Supreme Court was sort of, my words, sort of infusing the federal constitutional principles into the statute. The statute has to be applied in a way consistent with the Constitution, which is always true, and so therefore was referring to Fuchsia, for example. But what you just said, I think, is as a matter of federal constitutional law, there's no requirement in the due process clause that the exact same diagnosis that existed at the time of the commitment remains at the time of the discharge proceedings.
That's correct, yeah.
But what about under state statutes? Does state statute require that the person still be mentally ill at the time of discharge proceedings?
They still need to suffer from some sort of mental illness, yes, but
In order for the commitment to be continued?
Yes, but I don't think that it requires that the mental illness be the exact same mental illness that resulted in their initial commitment, although in this case, he was diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder.
So what statutory provisions are you relying on when you say that?
I'm relying on the discharge statute. I think it's, I can't remember the exact number off the top of my head. And that the interpretation, again, of the discharge criteria in Call versus Gomez, which did interpret the mentally ill and dangerous statute.
So you consider that to be a construction of the statute.
Right. I think what Call versus Gomez did is the statute indicates that the factors are disjunctive, so that the person either
The statutory factors you mean?
Yeah, the statutory factors indicate that are disjunctive. So the person can be committed if they are not capable of making an acceptable adjustment to society, or they continue to pose a danger to the public, or they continue to need treatment and supervision for a mental disorder. What Call versus Gomez did is said, no, under FUSHA, the U.S. Supreme Court case, those factors need to be conjunctive. You need to read them together. So a person has to be discharged if either they no longer pose a danger to the public or they no longer need treatment and supervision for a mental disorder.
Okay.
So, Your Honor.
Well, but the criteria I'm looking at don't use the words mental disorder or mental illness. Here's what it says. The patient who is mentally ill and dangerous shall not be discharged unless, ... the patient is capable of making an acceptable adjustment to open society, ... is no longer dangerous to the public, ... and is no longer in need of treatment and supervision.
Right.
I guess my original question is, where in state statute is there a requirement that a person must remain mentally ill in order to for the commitment to continue?
I guess you're right then. I suppose there is no requirement in state statute.
Well, I'm not trying to.
No, I think if that's what the statute says, then you're correct. But I think Call versus Gomez and federal constitution law would still require there to be a reasonable relation between the original commitment and continued commitment, meaning that there needs to be some sort of mental disorder that still exists, even if it doesn't necessarily rise to the level of the criteria for initial commitment.
Do you contend that Dr. Gierock was not competent to opine as to whether the patient has a mental illness?
No, Your Honor. I think he just, and as the panel said, I think he just misread the case law to require appellant to continue to suffer from schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder rather than antisocial personality disorder. And I think as the commitment appeal panel clearly said, there is a reasonable relation between the original commitment and continued commitment under Call if the person continues to need treatment and supervision for a disorder and continues to need to pose a danger to the public. And here, Dr. Gierock testified that those criteria were met, and he also testified that that there's a reasonable relation between the original commitment and this antisocial personality disorder because the antisocial personality disorder, he testified, is precisely what led to the violent behavior that resulted in his initial commitment. Also, Your Honor, even if you determine that the statutory criteria for initial commitment for the definition of mental illness need to be met, in order to continue commitment, I think that's also the case here. Because as appellant concedes, a personality disorder amounts to a mental illness for the purpose of the statute and for the purpose of commitment as a person who's mentally ill and dangerous if it makes the person lack the ability to control their actions. And contrary to appellant's statements, Dr. Gierock testified that appellant is not able to control his actions. And I think the evidence of appellant's behavior during his commitment also demonstrates that. He committed several assaults initially, and then he went to prison, and he returned to MSH in September, I believe, of 2017. And while he hasn't committed any additional assaults since he returned to MSH, he's continued to engage in inappropriate behavior. He's made inappropriate sexual comments to female staff and stalked female staff. He's threatened staff. He's verbally abused staff. He's made harassing phone calls.
We're aware of that. Dr. Gierock goes on, notwithstanding all that, to say, I support discharge because I don't think he has the kind of mental illness that either meets the commitment criteria or really is appropriate to treatment in this particular setting. So, my concern is that there's enough sort of fact-based opinions and evidence, testimony from the doctor, as opposed to sort of the legal impact of that, to at least get to the second phase of a hearing and to flesh out the facts maybe not his legal interpretation, but the facts on what he understands the nature of this mental illness and what treatment is appropriate. Why don't we at least get to the full second phase of the hearing?
Your Honor, because again, Dr. Gierak testified that those criteria in call were met, and that's the standard that appellant's burden to present a prima facie case to show that he's entitled to discharge at that original hearing, and he didn't do that because Dr. Gierak testified that he didn't meet. Even though his ultimate opinion indicated that he did, his testimony indicated that he didn't meet those criteria. And you know, looking also at the actual statute, which defines a person who is mentally ill as a person who suffers from a substantial psychiatric disorder that affects thought, mood, perception, et cetera, and affects their behavior and is evidenced by instances of grossly disturbed behavior. Well, Dr. Gierak testified that antisocial personality disorder is listed as a psychiatric disorder in the DSM-5, the preeminent, you know, text for diagnosing psychiatric disorders in the field of psychology and psychiatry. He testified that the disorder is severe and extreme, indicating that it's substantial. And he testified, by the way, that substantial psychiatric disorder is not a term of art in psychology. He testified that that's a legal term. He also testified that it affects appellant's mood and that it impairs his behavior and has clearly been evidenced by these assaults and other instances of this type of grossly disturbed behavior. And contrary to appellant's statements, nowhere in the statute does it say that you need to have a major mental illness in order to be committed. Major mental illness, something like schizophrenia, is not necessary. And this court stated that in a case that's cited in the brief In re matter of Nelson. So I would, I believe my time's about up, and I would encourage the panel to affirm the commitment appeal panel's order dismissing appellant's petition for discharge and any other relief. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dietrich. Mr. Hager, you have an opportunity for rebuttal. At the outset, I would like to clarify something I meant to clarify earlier. Just to be clear, so before the Special Review Board, there were three requests: transfer, provisional discharge, and discharge. So. Am I correct in understanding that on appeal you're only pursuing discharge, full discharge?
On this appeal?
Correct.
Yes, we...
The other issues are by the way.
And it's so troubling procedurally. I mean, this really disrupts the nature. I mean, it goes against Coker v. Jensen for... you know, if this is going to become standard practice to undercut our own examiner that comes out with credible evidence, we assume he's credible, he was appointed. And, you know, we very much want a second phase hearing, and we think we earned the right to a second phase hearing. There may be another examiner out there who disagrees with Dr. Gierak. I'm thinking there are examiners out there who totally agree with him because we saw them at the district court level. We've seen them in the case law. There's examiners out there who will say this form of antisocial personality disorder does not rise to the level of a mental illness. And we don't think that's an incompetent version, and we think the panel got the facts wrong. If they want to get the facts right, they need an examiner who's going to say, yes, he's completely without any control over his actions.
What facts did the commitment appeal panel get wrong?
They said, well, a slight improvement does not mean he's control himself. And then they were using a standard that he should be under control, you know, from the statute. So the facts are that he has improved. Dr. Gierak talked about his improvement. He's controlled his assaultive behavior. This is not the kind of person that was talked about in Johnson versus Newt. This is not somebody who's completely lost control, and it would be malpractice to put him on the street. No, this is a person less than that standard. That standard, which was applied by the panel, has no factual basis. They made it up. This is This is not how we want our panel to proceed on phase one hearings. The burden that he is still mentally ill is on the state. That's what a phase two hearing is about.
Would you agree it's rather unusual for an examiner to analyze case law and to base an opinion on an interpretation of case law instead of, you know, clearly stated statutory criteria?
No, I think that's just being thorough. I mean, the case law is always part of what examiners are going with, and the case law changes and changes what their opinion can be, like Call v. Gomez. They have to read those. He's trained. That's why a court hires a forensic examiner independently or listens to parties can provide their own forensic examiners as well to be advised in the application of the facts to the law. And examiners have driven this area of the law, by the way, if you read Johnson versus Newt.
What if the examiner has misinterpreted the case law? Then is his...
Yes.
Professional opinion still entitled to the same weight?
Could be. It could be if it impacts his ultimate opinion as to application of the facts of the law, yeah. But he did not get it wrong. He did a careful review.
Well, he said that let me look at it. I can't find the exact excerpt right now, but I think he said because Opiatch's diagnosis has changed, he seemed to have a very narrow understanding of the reasonable relationship concept from the case law. And because the psychosis that he previously was diagnosed with is no longer exists, even though he still has ASPD, Dr. Gehrig said that he's, you know, therefore the case law has not been satisfied.
No. Mr. Opiatcha was not committed on the basis of antisocial personality disorder behavior. He was committed on the basis of schizophrenic behavior, what was believed to be schizophrenic. There was a variance of opinion on that. It turned out it wasn't, he doesn't have schizophrenic behavior. There is no reason for him to be at MSH. I don't think historically there's more evidence of no rational relation. The treating facility is saying, we don't want him. He doesn't qualify for what we provide. No, there was no rational. He's right. A reasonable examiner may disagree with him, but I don't think it's the place of the panel in a phase one hearing to come down with these pronouncements about what the law is. I think he got it right. He followed Jamie Anderson. He followed the district court's determination on that. I think that's good enough.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hager. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days.